to say, let's roll the tape, so I guess we'll roll the tape. Okay, my name is Barbara Collins. I teach at California Lutheran University, and the title of the session this morning is Our Threatened Environment. And I want to discuss some of the problems concerned with that. First off, this morning, I'm not going to speak about all the environmental problems, much too much to talk about, but I do want to mention a few of the more important ones. And these are problems that we really cannot ignore any longer. They're not going to go away, and if we don't do anything about it, it could possibly be too late. We've known about these problems for some time. It isn't anything new. We've known about them, many of them, for at least 20 years, but I think the time is coming now for action that we really need to do something. I'm going to speak this morning. First, I'm going to talk about the greenhouse effect. I'm going to talk about acid rain. I'm going to talk about the ozone hole, pollution, particularly in the oceans, and then finally, deforestation, the tropical forest. For each one of the topics, first I want to mention what the problem is, a little bit about the history of it, how we've discovered it, and then why it is a problem. What are some of the things that could happen if we tend to ignore the particular situation? And then lastly, mention some things perhaps that we can do about it. Okay, first thing I want to mention is the greenhouse effect. And the first question is, what is it? Well, it's a situation when you have gases, particularly carbon dioxide is one of the main greenhouse gases, but there are others also, that cause a warming of the Earth's surface. What happens? It's sort of like your car. You know, in the summertime, you close up the windows of your car, and it heats up incredibly. You leave the car in the morning, and lunchtime you come out, and you're just about snuffed out, particularly if you live in California. What's happening? The sun comes in through the window of your car, and it gets through very nicely. But the problem is it bounces off your upholstery in the form of infrared or heat. And that heat then is trapped by the glass. It doesn't get out, and so your car warms up. It gets incredibly hot. You burn your hands on the steering wheel. Well, the same thing is happening in our environment, except it isn't glass window that we have. Instead, we have atmospheric gases, and one of the chief ones is carbon dioxide. Sun again gets through the atmosphere, it bounces across again from the ground, the earth and everything bounces out, and this time in the form of heat or infrared, and it's the carbon dioxide that holds the heat in. Of course, a little bit of this is desirable, but not a lot, and that can be the problem. Okay, what is the cause of the greenhouse effect here, the particular gases? Carbon dioxide is the most important one, but there are other gases too. These include ozone, nitrous oxide, CFCs, and methane. And I'll mention each one of these in a bit. Okay, where did they come from, these particular gases? Most of them come from fossil fuel burning. Now that's gas, coal, oil. All of us are burning these, of course. The automobile. Okay, what about some of the others? Methane. We get methane gas. I don't think that's really probably one of the bigger problems, but we do get methane gas whenever you have an anaerobic environment. That would be the landfills, for example. Methane gas seeps up from there. That would be a greenhouse effect. Ozone and nitrous oxide. People in California, these are the big ones we have there. Ozone, from the burning of gasoline, you get ozone. It's a photochemical reaction you get in the atmosphere, and it turns to ozone. So our LA smog, a good deal of it is ozone. And of course the nitrogen oxides, a lot of that from burning from the automobile. So all the big parking lot from the suburbs into LA, of course, accounts for a good deal of that. Carbon dioxide would be, of course, normal animal respiration. Would be burning any of your fuels gives off carbon dioxide. Even a clean burning, you see, gives carbon dioxide, whether it's alcohol we're using or whatever we're using, you get carbon dioxide. And a little side effect here, cutting down the tropical forest, which I'll speak about a little bit later, helps to increase the carbon dioxide, because normally forests and greenery absorb the CO2. You know, the plants take in the carbon dioxide. So if we chop them down, that's more CO2. So that's a problem too. Lastly, CFCs. These are chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs. So it's a little bulletin board inside the dining hall that mentions about them, and I'll talk about those later on. But the CFCs are very efficient as a greenhouse gas. At present, that's not the biggest of the greenhouse gases, but the CFCs are 20,000 times more efficient than CO2 in the greenhouse gases. Where do you get the CFCs from? That would be those plastic foam cups, you know, the coffee cups, refrigerants, air conditioners. These are our CFCs, and the U.S. is a very large producer of the CFCs. Okay, what about the background of the greenhouse effect? We've really known about it for a long time. I remember mentioning it years ago when I was teaching. I remember I gave a talk at CLU talking about that years ago, and I guess that this girl comes up immediately after my talk and asks, "How old are you?" And I should have said, "Oh, well, approaching 90. But anyhow, I remember talking about the greenhouse effect in the 60s. And it was, you know, a topic of conversation and talking about, but no one was worried about it. It's not going to happen to us. It wasn't really a popular topic. Early 80s, there was more talk about the greenhouse effect, but still, the U.S., we're not really worried about it. The particular attitude, well, let's study it. That's our typical attitude. Last summer, there was a really hot spell in Washington, D.C., and several top scientists met with Congress, and James Hansen from NASA, Institute of Space Studies, indicated that he was 99% certain that the greenhouse effect was upon us. Now, of course, there are many doubters, but still, the thing is, do we dare to wait and find out? Because you see, it could be too late. Interestingly, 1980s have the four hottest years on record. Some other statistics concerning carbon dioxide in 1880, this is a little over 100 years ago, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was 280 parts per million. 1980, up to 350 parts per million. We're increasing considerably. The estimate is that by the year 2050, if we don't do much about it, it could be up to double this, 700 parts per million. And next question is, well, why worry about it? So we've got a little carbon dioxide, so it's going to get slightly warmer. Is this going to be a big deal? First off, we have to consider how much the temperature is going to rise. Now, we're talking about average temperature over the whole globe, not just in one particular area. Now, in the next 100 years or so, the temperature could rise something like 2 to 3 degrees centigrade. That's just an average temperature. Now, that doesn't sound like much. And that would be the amount if we have a very slowly developing world. On the other hand, if we don't do much about the situation and develop rapidly, it could be something like 5 to 10 degrees centigrade rise over the next perhaps 100 years. Just for a little frame of reference, since the last ice age, the total average warming of the Earth was only 5 degrees centigrade. And we're talking 5 to 10 degrees centigrade in the next 100 years. So this is worth considering. The melting of the ice from the last glacial age resulted in bringing the Atlantic Ocean inland 100 miles and created the Great Lakes. So that's what happened in this 5 degrees warming since the last ice age. If instead we cut back fuel, fossil fuel use, and if we were to ban the CFCs, we could reduce this warming to as little as 1.4 degrees centigrade. So we could, instead of this 2 to 3 or 5 to 10, it would be possible to make it as low as 1.4 degrees centigrade. Let me read a statement from Baker, who's Secretary of State. He said, and I quote, "We face the prospect of being trapped on a boat that we have irreparably damaged, not by the cataclysm of war, but by the slow neglect of a vessel we believe to be impervious to our abuse. The political ecology is now ripe for action." Some other aspects about the warming up. Obviously, we have polar ice caps still. There could be melting here, so the people that are going to be most vulnerable are those, of course, along the coast. Many nations will be seriously threatened. For example, Bangladesh, that's not doing too well anyhow. In our country, Miami, Galveston would be very vulnerable, perhaps a good deal of the East Coast. Some of the islands will be threatened. Hurricanes are believed to be, will become more serious and more frequent. So these are little problems. Not only this, but there should probably be a change in climate. Now, some areas we can say might fare fairly well. If you happen to be living in Siberia, maybe a little warmth might be welcome. But in a good part of the world, this is not the situation. For example, our bread belt will probably become warmer and more arid, which means that it will be difficult to produce the amount of grains that we're producing now. The bread belt will be moved north into Canada, but they don't have appropriate soil, so it will no longer be a bread belt. They've got a shallow acid soil there, not appropriate for growing grains. So these are problems, climate problems. Next question is, what can we do about it? It is a serious problem. Probably the most important thing that we have to consider is energy conservation. We need to burn less fuel, particularly fossil fuel. We need cars with better mileage. Here in the U.S., we have this desire for the big gas guzzlers, 15 miles per gallon or 17 or 22. We've got to do better than that. It's nice to think that it's the rest of the world, but it isn't. It is mostly us. The U.S. and the Soviet Union produce 45% of the world's CO2, and we certainly aren't 45% of the world's population. The U.S. alone, 25%, one quarter of the CO2 is from the U.S. alone. What do we need to do? Maybe we need to look at solar power, put more money into this. We have to perhaps consider nuclear power in spite of the problems with the disposal of the waste. Deforestation, we've got to stop deforestation and consider that. We need to eliminate the CFCs, not just cut them down to 1986 level, which is the proposal at present. As I mentioned before, the CFCs are 20,000 times more efficient in trapping the heat than carbon dioxide. Perhaps one thing would be to raise the cost of fuel, to maybe cut down fuel use. Plant trees, reforestation. What can we individually do about it? Again, we've got to support the senators or candidates that support the environment. Write to your senator, your congressman. We need to give money to lobbying groups that support the environment. We have to put some of our money here. This is really about the only way that we can be heard. Perhaps drive less and carpool more. Use a car that gets good mileage. Conserve electricity. Hang the clothes out if you can. Turn the lights out and use solar power for heating your water. So these are all kinds of things that we can do. What I'll do is probably mention a bunch of problems, and then afterwards you can ask questions or throw in comments. The second problem is acid rain. All of these really interrelate, as you're going to see. The ozone hole, acid rain, greenhouse effects, they're all interrelated and all basically stem from our desire for energy, gas, and fuel and such. Second one is acid rain. And I'm sure you've heard a lot about it. I even have a T-shirt here about acid rain, but unfortunately it's so cold that the greenhouse effect isn't working too well today. But here's my acid rain T-shirt for you. Well, anyhow, I'm sure you've heard about acid rain, and what actually is it? Acid rain is any rain that has a pH lower than 5.6. Okay, what do we mean by pH? It's a measure of hydrogen ion concentration, and essentially, the way it works is the lower you go in numbers, the more acid is the substance we're measuring. Neutral substance would have a pH of 7. If you have a pH of 6, it's 10 times more acid. A pH of 5 is 100 times more acid, okay? So acid rain is anything lower than 5.6. Okay, how acid does your rain get? Pretty acid. Sometimes it can be as low as 2.9, and that's about the acidity of vinegar. So we got raining vinegar on us. Pasadena in 1978, pH of 4. Scotland in the 70s, pH of 2.4. December 1982, pH of 1.7 in LA. So it is acid in certain places. What causes it? Again, it's the fossil fuel burning. But in this case, it's not the carbon dioxide so much, it's more nitrogen oxides and sulfur oxides. If you live in the East Coast or the Eastern area, it's burning coal and it's the sulfur. If you live on the West Coast, it's mostly the gasoline from the automobiles, and it's mostly nitrogen oxides. What happens? These gases rise up into the atmosphere, they mix with the moisture up there. The nitrogen oxides turn into nitric acid, the sulfur oxides turn into sulfuric acid, and you get raining down sulfuric acid and nitric acid. In the event that you live in an area that there isn't much rainfall, you still get it. It's just in the form of what we call acid deposition. It comes down as pretty much almost solid particles that land on the plants and will burn the leaves and harm them. An interesting thing, I think it was last year or the year before, we have really severe forest fires or shrub fires, maybe you better call them, in the chaparral. And they usually start July, August, but sometimes we get them earlier. I remember a couple of years ago they were remarking how bad the fires were, particularly along the freeways, because a lot of the plants were dead. And they couldn't imagine why the plants were all dying. And to me, it seemed perfectly obvious. It's the acid deposition, all those automobiles along the freeway, and they can't imagine why the plants are dead. And of course, the plants are dying, and then this makes them even more vulnerable to the fires that come. Well, anyway, so it's the nitrogen oxide and the sulfur oxides that ultimately result in this acid rain problem. When do we first notice it? Sweden was probably the first of the countries to notice the acid rain problem. That was back in the 60s. They were downwind, you see, from all the industrial burning in England, and they noticed that a lot of their lakes were dying. The fish were dying, and they seemed dead in that sense. What was this mysterious thing? And they related it to acid rain and related it also to the burning of coal in England. The next country to notice it was Canada. And this was probably in the 70s, they noticed the same thing. A lot of the lakes were dying and the fish, no fish. And again, the problem, acid in the lakes. Next question, why in these particular areas? Canada is very vulnerable because they're underlain by a granitic rock. It doesn't decompose readily. Well, it's cold anyhow. So the soil is shallow and it tends to be acid anyway. If you have acid rain running down, the acid then runs immediately into the lakes and causes a problem. So Canada was quite vulnerable. The areas where they noticed the problem were just downwind from the smelters, Sudbury Nickel Smelter, for example. And this one spills out tons and tons of pollutants each day, actually. 1.3 million tons a year. just pollutants spilling out. Well, of course, right around the smelter, they began to notice that the plants were dying. Oh my goodness, something's wrong. So they had an easy solution to the problem. Let's just build a smokestack higher so that the pollutants, you know, don't kill the plants in the vicinity. Well, so they ended up building this smokestack, and it was 1,200 feet high. You know, out of sight, out of mind, right? So, but the problem was all the pollutants went downwind, and they just ended up either in our area, New England area, or just further away. Just the problem was not out of mind. Maybe it was out of sight for the people from the nickel smelter area, but certainly not out of mind. It just pushed it further down the line. In the early 80s, Canada tried to get us interested in the problem, but you know how our activity at that point was. Well, let's study it. And so let's make a 10-year study on the problem. That was 1980, so the 10-year study is supposed to be over in 1990. Rather interesting, the midpoint of this monumental study should have been in 1985. Well, they didn't get out a report until 1987. And the initial report that was to come out probably would have come out in 86 and did indicate the problem, but then very strong lobbying interests from the states that burn the coal, produce the coal, and so on. The final report that came out in 87 was very highly biased. And the gist of it was, we're doing just fine, nothing to worry about, just the industry will take care of the problem and nothing to worry about. Fortunately, not all the congressmen agreed with this particular report. Okay, the next question is, why is the acid rain a problem? No biggie. Kill a few trees in the chaparral, but why is it a problem? Well, a lake normally has a pH of 8. Okay, we've got rain coming down with 5.6 or lower. Most of it's 4, pH of 4 or less. So what's going to happen? The pH of your lake's going to drop. We find that by the time the lake reaches a pH of 5, a lot of fish and animals are threatened, are gone. And many of the fish, of course, the best fish are gone by the time you hit a pH of 5. Lower than this, pretty much death of the lake becomes anaerobic, no oxygen in it. And then, of course, you're going to have bubbles of methane and CO2 coming up, and that's, guess what, the greenhouse effect. The lakes are dead, fish and plants die. What else happens? The forests are harmed. They're very alarmed about the death of the Schwarzwald in Germany being threatened by acid rain. The mountains above California, San Bernardino Mountains, are threatened. All the forests are being threatened in the East Coast also. Why is this? Apparently the acid rain leaches the nutrients out of the soil. The acid on the leaves are harmful. Both harm the forests. Eastern coast, the water may be threatened because of the acid in the rain and the leaching. You have more nitrates and stuff in the water, causing blooms of algae and ultimately snuffing out some of the water and some of the organisms there. Food crops are going to be threatened with the acid on the leaves and such. What about the effect on man? We don't really know about this, but again, if we're leaching things like aluminum and mercury out of the rocks and out of the soil into the water, conceivably we can be drinking now water that contains aluminum and some of these substances, and you don't really know the effect. It's been suggested there is a relationship between aluminum and Alzheimer's disease. So these are unknowns. Again, what can we do about it? I've all heard about, this one may sound familiar, like guns don't kill, people do, but we can change this around and say something like this: machines don't pollute, people do. So again, it comes right back to us. I mean, you can blame the machines and everyone, but who's using them? Tennessee River Valley is certainly not immune. It's nice to talk about the Sudbury nickel plant in Canada, but we're worse off, actually. Tennessee River Valley burns tons and tons of oil and coal probably, and one of the worst polluters, 2.5 million tons of pollutants a year. we need to cut down our burning of coal. Coal's a very dirty fuel with a lot of sulfur in it. Again, overpopulation certainly does compound the problem, but again, we like to think it's the other people, but it's us who are doing most of the polluting. And again, the same old thing, we need to use a car with better fuel economy and carpool if possible. The spread of the acid rain very closely parallels our appetite for energy. Okay, moving on to the ozone hole. You've probably been hearing about this in the news. Normally, way up in the stratosphere, way up high, probably about 30 miles up, we have a layer of ozone. Very important that it be there, because if it were not, ultraviolet radiation coming from the sun would get through to the earth. Okay, if we didn't have that ozone protective layer, life would not be possible as we know it here on Earth, because there would be too much radiation coming in, cause mutations and probably death of most organisms. But fortunately, we do have this atmosphere, we have the ozone that protects us from this ultraviolet radiation. The concern now is that should this ozone layer disappear, what might happen here on Earth? Okay, what's the cause of the destruction of the ozone layer? It's the chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs. And again, as I mentioned, there's a little thing in the bulletin board up there in the dining hall concerning this. These are compounds that are present in the aerosols and refrigerants, air conditioners, those little foam containers, you know, you get in McDonald's or the foam cups. All right, what about the history of the situation with the ozone hole? The CFCs were first produced in the 1930s, and they look like they're the ideal chemical compound. They look perfect. They don't decompose, non-corrosive, non-reactive, non-toxic, ideal. And so we then started to produce quite a few of these. What happened? 1974, a couple of professors from UC Irvine, University of California, Irvine, wanted to see what actually happened to these molecules, the CFCs, do they sit around forever? Do they never react with anything? So what they do is to check some of them and discovered that probably after about 50 years, they very slowly migrate up to the stratosphere. They kick around here for a long period of time, very slowly migrate up to the stratosphere. Then what happens? Once they're up there, they are hit with ultraviolet radiation, which is very potent radiation, and it breaks open the CFCs so that a chlorine molecule is released. Okay, what happens? This then reacts with the ozone, causing a reaction to destroy the ozone. And just one chlorine atom can destroy something like 100,000 molecules of ozone. So you don't need a lot of it, you see, to begin to break down the ozone. And the next question is, why over the Antarctic is this hole? Apparently the polar clouds that are very cold cause the reaction. So the coldness and the CFCs getting up into the stratosphere causes to happen. Well, it was just talk, you see, in 1974 when these professors mentioned what would happen. And I don't think they even thought much would happen, although we did make an attempt at banning the aerosols. But it wasn't until 1985 that, to the surprise of everyone, that there really was a hole over the Antarctic. It was first discovered then. And people then, of course, became alarmed. And of course, now over the Arctic, we notice that, again, it's very thin and much more than they had expected. So it has happened. There has been destruction of the ozone. What can we do about it? What is the problem? As I mentioned before, the ultraviolet radiation can get into the Earth. Don Holdall at the time this was first discovered, Department of the Interior. One of our concerned statements said, no problem, just wear sunglasses and put on sunscreen. A bunch of environmental activists then went to the White House, and they put sunglasses on the animals and sombreros on the animals, just showing how ridiculous it was, because you see, it isn't just us, it's the animals, it's the plants. How do we put sunscreen on the plants? You see, it's rather ridiculous. So what could happen? You see, the ultraviolet radiation could harm our crops, could harm plankton in the ocean. An estimate that maybe by the year 2050, we could have a crop loss as much as 2.6 billion because of this. Could alter the climate. Again, a bunch of unknowns that we don't really know. What about CFCs? The U.S. is the largest producer of CFCs. We produce something like $750 million worth each year. And there could be, the industry itself could be something like $2 billion a year. And we need to stop the production of them. Not, our present plans are to, this was a meeting in Montreal, was to make a freeze in 1990 to the production of the 1986 level, which was mighty high. 2000 will reduce it 35 to 50%. But you see, this is much, much too inadequate, much too little. There's so much of the stuff already in the environment that has not anywhere near gotten up to the stratosphere. You see, it takes 50 years, so we're just now beginning to experience what was 50 years ago. And we're continuing to produce the stuff, mass quantity. You can see what's yet to come. So these are certainly problems. Okay, moving on to water. I am not going to mention the inland waters, although that is probably almost a session in itself, talking about the inland water and pollution. But I do want to mention the ocean, which a lot of us tend to ignore, and we have ignored up until probably last year. We hadn't really thought about it. We hear about the oil spills. You all heard about the Alaska spill, the one on the East Coast. These hit the news. What you don't hear about is as bad or worse. This is the intentional dumping of oil and pollutants into the ocean daily. Cities are allowed to barge their waste out into the ocean and dump it. Ships clean their bilge, hose off the deck into the ocean. We don't adequately treat our sewage and it gets dumped into the ocean. We don't hear about this, the intentional dumping. Last summer, you heard about the beaches in the East Coast and how they had to close them because of the tampons, syringes, human waste coming up on the beach. We've been dumping for years, and it really haven't been thinking about it much until rather recently. Thor Heyerdahl, he was the one who wrote the book Kon-Tiki, and he went across the ocean in this little, I don't know what you want to call it, a little dinghy or a little boat. And anyway, he went across the ocean in the year 1947 and again in 69. 1947, he indicated that the ocean was fairly clean. But in 1969, he mentioned that a good deal of the ocean, even in the middle, pollutants, tar, balls of tar, oil, slicks of oil over the surface, plastics, cans, fish nets all over the surface of the ocean. There were times when you just wouldn't want to even put your hand into the ocean. Here you are in the middle of the ocean. A lot of difference between the 2 years, 1969, 1947. And the thing is, this is intentional dumping. This is not those few oil spills that are unintentional. The U.S. dumps 390,000 tons of pollutants a day. This is into the ocean. The incredible thing is that the ocean is no more than a big lake. We've considered it. I think we think about we're in the flat earth society, you know, and it just rolls over the edge, you know. But the ocean, if you go up above the earth, you see that the ocean is no more than a lake. And it's not bottomless pit that we've thought, oh, well, it's out of sight, out of mind again. But you can't continually dump into the ocean forever. Boston Harbor, you heard about that during the election. What about it? You got 3 million people living in Boston within a 25-mile radius of the harbor. And nearly all of the human and industrial waste goes into the harbor. DDTs, PCBs there in the bottom of the harbor. The sewage treatment is incredible. 1977 was the Clean Water Act, which required that all cities bring their water at least to the secondary treatment, sewage treatment. Boston and New York, however, and some other big cities, coastal cities, received waivers that they did not have to do this. And nothing has been done to update the facilities, which means that these cities are using only primary treatment of the sewage. What's primary treatment? Well, you separate the solids from the liquid, and then if you live on the East Coast, you dump them both in the ocean. So it sounds incredible, but it's true. Storms overload the system, and then I guess you don't even get around to separating it. It goes direct into the ocean because the water from the rain overloads your sewage system, and then it goes direct into the ocean. A lot of in the system, too, what you put into the gutter ends up in the ocean, too. So you sweep your dog doo-doo into the gutter, and the next day your kids are swimming in it in the ocean. All of that ends up in the ocean. Some cities, particularly around where we live, we have a tertiary treatment, not only secondary, but tertiary treatment of the sewage in which you can then recycle the water. It is essentially drinkable quality. What we need to do is have that in all our big cities and then use that water. Unfortunately, a good deal of this water is not being used. It ends up in the ocean again. It should be used for your lawns. I would hope that sometime in the future we could have two kinds of faucets, one for in which you would use recycled water for washing the car or whatever, irrigating your lawn for the toilets. You certainly don't need drinkable quality water it is drinkable quality. You could use recycled water for the toilets and for watering the lawn and everything, and have a one small spigot for drinking water. Then we could be a little more use in that sense. So I think the thing that we need to realize that the ocean is not a bottomless pit. We need to stop dumping things into the ocean. We have to begin to become concerned about it. Fish, plankton, it could actually be the source of our life. Plankton produce the oxygen necessary and also take out some of the carbon dioxide. Again, what can we do? We need to use recycled water. We need to put our money into any kind of things like this. 1991, Boston is supposed to stop the dumping of sludge. In 1999, they're supposed to begin secondary treatment. Lastly, I want to talk about the tropical forest, what's happening here. Here you read about the burning, the slash and burn in the Brazilian forest. Probably something like 28 million acres of forest are lost each year. Actually, this is probably an underestimate. In this destruction, probably a fifth of our species may become extinct in the next 20 years. What's called some other kinds of things that could happen, increase in carbon dioxide because the trees aren't using it, increase in the greenhouse effect. Why are we clearing the tropical forest? One thing, of course, houses, building, using it for lumber, also clearing for agriculture. Unfortunately, the land in the tropics is very poor. You can grow crops on it perhaps 1 year at best, but then that's it. It's excellent for building for building material because it's a clay that becomes very, very compact, but for growing crops, it's not good. And so they cut down an area, it's no good after a couple of years, move on, and this is a problem. What's happening in Rondônia, which is an area in western Brazil, is typical of what's happening throughout the area. This is a area that you probably haven't heard about. They just opened up a highway there 4 years ago, and now 6 million acres have been destroyed, an area the size of the state of Vermont. The Brazilian part of the Amazon basin alone, 20 million acres of virgin forest are burned each year. You hear about the burning in the Brazilian forest, but every habitat is really at risk. In the U.S., we're destroying forests. California, the trees are chopped down daily for more houses, building, and expansion. So it's a problem not just in the tropical forest, but also here at home. It's a bit, just a little bit slower, maybe less spectacular. Hawaii has tropical forests that are disappearing. Species extinction is probably one of the biggest worries here. 1.7 million species have been cataloged on Earth, but probably we have a lot more than these. And the Amazon has half of these particular species, and when we destroy this area, we may lose a lot of species. Bruce Rich of the Environmental Defense Fund says the following, and I quote, "Tropical deforestation is the number one most important issue facing mankind and a real threat for survival." We don't often think of this as being that much of a problem, but extinction of species could result in considerable harm because we're going to lose these species forever. We will lose their gene pool in a changing world. Maybe we might not be able to survive. To bring closer to home what the rate of destruction is, it's something like 50 acres a minute or 3,000 acres an hour. Now, most of us can't picture what 50 acres a minute is, and I'll try to get this a little closer to home in a bit. But the extinction also is something like two or three species every hour. In other words, while I'm just sitting here talking, we probably lost two or three species. Another thing, while I've been talking here, probably we've lost something like 60 football fields of land forever. An area the size of the village here, you know, just up the chalets and around here, probably go in the first 10 minutes. In the first hour, we probably use all of the village, you know, out to the ballpark, up the mountains here and on both sides, up to the mine, and everything would go within the hour time. So it's going rapidly. And probably the big concern is the fact that, again, the loss of the forest means more CO2, less oxygen, future medicines maybe that will be destroyed, the genes, survival of the species. These are all kinds of concerns. So, again, I think we have to be aware of the problem and lobby for protection of the forest. Support any groups that are doing anything for protecting the wildlife and the environment. I'd like to summarize this, and then we'll open the floor for questions. The U.S. accounts for less than 5% of the population, yet we consume one quarter of the energy each year. And even for that, which we use, we produce less than does Germany and Japan. So we're very inefficient, is what it boils down to. We generate 15% of the SO2 and 25% of the CO2 and nitrogen oxides. Each American produces an average of 3.5 pounds of trash a day. We own more than 135 million cars, a third of the world's total. Perhaps some of the things we really need to be concerned with, perhaps what we need to do is raise the gasoline tax, raise the price of gas, toughen auto fuel efficiency requirements. In other words, the cars that are being produced by the U.S. industry should have much better miles per gallon, something like 45 instead of much lower. We need to encourage recycling of waste. Natural gas versus use of coal. And maybe we need to encourage giving up, in other words, some of the cutting down the tropical forests is to get money so they can pay us. Well, maybe we can say, okay, keep the tropical forest, forget the debt. Ratify the law of the sea, and maybe we should make the environment a summit issue. It's certainly serious. And very important is education. Every individual on the planet should be made aware of the vulnerability of the planet, so we do need to educate. We only have years, we don't have generations. Things we should consider: recycle, procreate less, turn off the lights, use mass transit. We need long-term policies rather than short-term policies. More cooperation, global agendas, and a focus on the future. It's time we steered by the stars rather than the lights of each passing ship. And one final comment. When God gave humans the dominion over the earth, did he choose an appropriate group? The jury is still out, and the answer has to come in our time from the political system. So these are weighty problems, and unfortunately it isn't a cheery kind of topic, but I think we do have to face it. We can't be oblivious of it. And the solution is not going to be easy. It's not going to be pleasant. Do you have any questions or comments? Yeah.
Well, it's pretty obvious we're going to have to get down on our materialism, how many of us are willing to do it.
Yeah, I think...
How are we willing to give up for the environment that in favor of our children and grandchildren?
Yeah.
It's what we're up against.
Yeah, this is really what it boils down to. We have to think of our children and our grandchildren, and can we and will we give up some of our luxuries?
Well, we're greedy.
Yeah.
We are so greedy and so selfish, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And only the thinking people will have any motivation at all to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we approach this?
The other thing that's happening is that that we're teaching our children to want the same things.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the crux of it. I think we've got to, even our own families, we've got to begin to cut down and teach your children. I remember when the plastic bags came out, the little plastic baggies, they're not biodegradable, and we made our kids bring them home, you know, and that's very embarrassing. You have to bring your lunch bag to school, and you don't throw away the baggies, you bring it home, and then we recycle them, and those are hard things. But maybe if the teachers in school would encourage that you wouldn't feel different, maybe for the little kids, maybe we through teaching in the younger grades. Yes?
I went to our local disposal company and got the director to come and speak to our student body in Logan Elementary School, about 450 students, about the recycling and the problem of overfilling the landfills. And as a result, we sparked up, and the kids went back to their parents, and now it's going into their neighborhoods, and they're collecting all glass, plastic, all glass, not just California redemption glass. In our state, we get a pen to redeem beer bottles, but all glass, newspaper, the plastic 2-liter bottles, including their screw-on aluminum lids, all that kind of thing. And the kids are getting their neighbors, the little ones, and their families to set up recycling centers in their garage and take these back to our redemption centers, which are located at most grocery stores.
That is excellent. And I picture that
people are starting to bring their own mugs to church and trying to get a move on to get rid of styrofoam cups.
Excellent. So it can be done, and maybe it's working starting with the kids. I think they can do it.
See, I think that's how, when the child comes home from school and he's learned it and starts preaching it at the parents, it works.
Right, exactly. Because the parents trying to teach to the kids doesn't work well. It has to come the other way, and the kids get all together and enthused about it. I think we can do something.
Yeah.
I have a question. In Seattle, at all the grocery stores, it's paper or plastic to have your things bagged in. I don't know about other areas. Mm-hmm. And now what we're getting is, well, this plastic is biodegradable. But it really isn't, I don't think. It just is broken in pieces, isn't it? And
I don't think it's readily biodegradable, yeah. Really.
That's my feeling.
In Seattle landfills, when the sun really doesn't even shine at all, they've had newspapers buried 3 years and they still haven't decomposed yet.
Well, they have no air.
Yeah.
Well, in a landfill, they cover the things anyway, so the sun wouldn't get penetrate. So it's pretty misleading.
Yeah, and I think that people shouldn't buy the industry of saying.
You know what we really should do? What they did in Germany, and I don't know if they still do it, but again, it's the to get people to do it. We used to always bring just a string bag to the grocery store, and they didn't supply you with paper bags or plastic.
Market baskets fine.
Yeah. So you could. We would have these string bags, and you just carry everything home there. And as I remember, I was over in New Zealand, and that was 2 years ago. They did not supply you with paper sacks.
That's still true in a lot of European countries. You bring your basket or your string bag, or if you have plastic bags, you bring them with you, and you keep using them over and over, and they charge you. Mm-hmm. Price for the bags.
That's a thought. If they could start charging, there you go. Then slowly raise the price and people just might decide. And then also make available these string bags that you can use yourself. And it might dawn on people if they're beginning to pay for the paper bags or plastic or whatever. Gee, maybe I'll just pay $1 and get the string bag and cut out the price.
I seriously question whether simply raising the price is, you know, or starting to raise a cost is going to be the solution. That becomes an immediate economic, pinch. But all it ends up doing is contributing to an inflationary spiral.
Mm-hmm.
Because when costs of living are increasing, then there's greater demand for income. That's not the issue as nearly as much. I mean, we can play that game and keep on going forever and still not solve the problem.
Well, what we have to do is make it the end thing to be the person with less, which is a total reversal of where we are now. Mm-hmm. The smaller home that you can heat well with the sun, the smaller car with that uses less gas and so forth. And if that became the thing to do, immediately you would be far out with your big home, with your big car, you know, with all the things that are destroying the environment. And this is where we need to get, and I'm not sure how to do it, but
the technology
needs to be done.
The technology for the car is already existent. You're dealing with lobbies that don't want that kind of technology to be the norm.
You come from the Los Angeles area, and Los Angeles is now trying to battle this pollution problem through all sorts of means. I mean, everything under the sun, they're trying to get everyone involved in it. One of them is, I believe, to do away with gas mowers and paraphernalia of that sort. Obviously, you've heard of some of the other comments, including cars. Do you know what those might be?
There's been some talk about things that need to be done, but actually, most of it is just talk on the surface, and nothing much has been done. They talk about mass transit, but there is. The expense for that is incredible, the way the setup is, and we really need to do something for incentives to get the car pooling. I think that's one of our big problems.
Most cities have buses and things which everybody still needs to avoid. So the bus companies going broke.
What specific environmental problems do you see right here at Holden Village that could be addressed that are not now being addressed?
look up behind us.
Yeah, that's a whole thing in itself, the taillights.
I have some good news, they are being addressed. Other than that,
yeah, I think it's good that we are certainly, I was glad to see that little thing about the CFCs, you know, that was good, and any cutting down any use of paper or this kind of thing is good.
I guess this would be a good opportunity to make a pitch right now. If you'd like to know what Holden is doing, I'll be leading a hike on Thursday at 2 o'clock, or you can help out with garbology any morning at 8:30 behind the hotel and learn what we do firsthand. And we do have some problems, and we incinerate all our paper and try to sort out all the plastic on that, but still sometimes plastic gets in it, and we burn that, and we're not sure what that does to the environment. And we do burn a lot of wood here in the wintertime. Working on trying to recycle plastic and heavier stuff.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'd like to throw out, I applaud the person who said they got the children involved in recycling. My experience in our community is that if you know, I certainly applaud all efforts to get recycling going, but evidently there's a limit to the market. And like, for example, paper, you know, there hasn't been much money paid out to paper because they evidently have enough paper as it is, and there's not enough companies that need paper to sell to. And this is an international problem of creating markets, so that if people do indeed recycle, then there have to be the markets to use those recyclable goods. And as I understand it, the government has been sort of subsidizing companies to use new mm-hmm. products. And so how do we get that system changed around? And then you mentioned government and lobbying and writing letters. Well, that's fine, except I've also had experience in talking to legislators, and like you mentioned, they have a very short vision. One mm-hmm. senator mm-hmm. said to me outright, if it isn't an immediate problem, I can't deal with it. And that is a sad state of affairs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm just really open to people's ideas. How do you get around these things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder, I was thinking of the whole needing a change of attitude of convenience. I mean, even back to the grocery store issue, I mean, we go in our car, the load up. I mean, in Europe, you always knew an American who went grocery shopping versus the person from the country, because from that particular country, because they would go often, you know, and get lesser things. The American wanted the convenience of going once a week and loading up and going home, and wanted the big refrigerators and the big, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a real mindset that we have here. So wanting things instantaneously and wanting to be able to do it quickly, which has a whole thing to do with our lifestyle. You know, we work long hours. There isn't much time. Right. To do these things, so you pile it all into one thing, so it becomes a very big issue in terms of sorting lots of things out, not just the ecological thing. Mm-hmm. I think some ecological things require time, and we're not willing to put the time in.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Sure. Well, like doing the wash. Takes time to hang the clothes out in the line and bring them in, and just easier to shove them in the dryer.
Yeah, but we've done this because we're so dedicated to having material things. The women have gone to work, everything is dedicated in our country to buying more things, whatever they are.
Yeah.
And this is what has forced the crisis, what's ruining everything. We've got to go back the other way.
Yeah, we need to go back 30, 40 years.
People didn't live like this in Mother and Dad's day.
Mm-hmm. In Oregon, they're recycling styrofoam into sidewalks at the local college, and the local plastics manufacturer is taking back all plastics. Milk jugs, cottage cheese cartons, margarine containers, we have a recycling bill, mm-hmm. Bottle bill, so every bottle and every can has to pay a price when you recycle in that way.
Mm-hmm.
all aluminum. We have roadside pickup of all of our glass and all of our paper. I have a friend who picks up all my cardboard, all my newspapers, all my junk mail.
Excellent. Where is this?
In Oregon.
Oregon.
Speaking about junk mail, do you know how to shut that off?
I mean, it's incredible. It gets worse and worse, and you think of this volumes of stuff.
Is there something you can do to post office at the post office so it isn't even delivered?
I don't think so.
They have to pay for it. Oh, that sounds good. At least that sounds good. I guess our time's about up, so.